So back to you, Gary, if you have any further comments on this. W2JXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
CE7DFI.
I mentioned TechNet. You got a copy?
I heard DSI, and I think I'm hearing somebody else. I believe there's a bit of a band opening today. DSI, your redhead spotter, what's your name, sir? My name is Dick. K2RIW, listening.
Good evening, Dick. Call sign here is Victor Echo 7 Delta Foxtrot India. I'm located right now just somewhere around JFK Airport. I wonder if at some time I could just ask a couple of very quick questions as to the repeaters that I could possibly use in and around Manhattan Island where I may be going tomorrow. QSL.
Yeah, this is the TechNet that you're in the middle of right now. The DSI. You didn't tell us your DFI. You didn't tell us your name. Okay. Let me pass it over to the man who is the former president of the Kings County Radio Club, K2KEY. Mel, why don't you give Mr. DFI a couple of suggestions for repeaters? You got it, Mel.
This is K2KEY. There's a lot of them, both on 2 meters and 70 centimeters, and depends on here, basically, which one of the two you're basically interested in. If you're interested in trying both 2 meters and 70 centimeters, they're so numerous, I would take quite a while to go down the list and tell you their frequencies and their PLs. Do you have one of the latest listings of the ARRL repeater handbook, over?
Negative. My book is about 5 or 6 years out of date. All I am looking for is a repeater that if I run against problems or need help or assistance in and around uptown and downtown Manhattan, I have a fair chance of contacting somebody on that machine. QSL?
Yeah, very fine, Robin. Mel, what do you think about the 147-000 machine, which I think is right in dead Manhattan? And in the past, it was a major machine on the air all the time. But you might know better than that, but Mel, go ahead.
Roger, that's also, there's another one on the ROW that's on 446-100, Dick. That's a very popular hangout for a lot of people. In fact, I've used that many times when I'm in the city, 446-100. And usually you just say listening or listen, you'll hear activity on that, Dick, over.
441.1, now?
Yeah, both of you guys, what's the PL on that machine?
You need to be at so here. I think that's 441.1. Not the 446, am I right now?
Yeah, but what's the PL on that machine?
I guess the book, yeah, Frank Warba, yeah, they say amazing on the local repeaters here also. Yeah, I believe he's right, 441.100. Frank, you usually all those repeaters, I'm always talking to you, you're in the train or something like that. What do you find the best, Frank? Go ahead.
That's 136.5, the K2JJ.
Yeah, ROW is probably one of the best. I think 445, I'm not sure the frequency, the repeater on the Empire State Building is also extremely good now. ROW, though located in downtown Brooklyn, has extremely good coverage of most of the city, I understand.
448.28.
Okay, 448.28, 441.100. Apparently both of those are 136.5. The 2 meter repeater on 147.000 down 600. Again, PL 136.5. So, and by the way, your repeater directory, I don't care if it's 6 years old, Robin, these repeaters in New York City move very slowly. You could use a repeater directory 10 years old, and you're going to get 95% accuracy out of it. VE7DFI, KQRIW, my name is Dick. Hey, Dick. 448.28 is 88.5 PL at 2FLF listening. Okay, 88.8, I think you said on that one. So, yeah, the 440 repeater is a little bit different on PL. Almost every New York City area and Long Island area repeater has 136.5 on 2 meters as the PL tone. Let's see if you need a fill in any of that, Robin. Go ahead.
I think you've given me enough information. That's all I wanted. I just wanted to make sure that I had contact, local contact if necessary, when I'm maybe poking around in that neck of the woods. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And here's Robin Romeo Oscar Bravo, India November, Hope QTH is Victoria, British Columbia. I'll let you go back to your net, and I thank you very much for letting me interrupt. Victor Echo 7, Delta, Foxtrot, India, somewhere around JFK Airport, is clear, 7-3.
Bye-bye, Robin, and good luck with that. Now, back to you, Gary. I wonder if you need a fill on some of this information you've got, which I know is quite different than what you've been hearing for years and years from people who sounded like they're experts. And standing wave ratio is by far near the top of the list, along with antenna technology in general, as to what is highly misunderstood by a huge percentage of supposedly informed radio amateurs. So what if you need a fill or want to have some further explanations on any of this jazz? It's a good subject, Gary, and even though we, Mel and I, go through this once every 3 months, it bears repeating because the number of people who misunderstand this information is huge. You got it, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your info, and I think I'm going to start believing what you're saying. Oh, here's the deer again. Wow. As it sits now with my three call axes, and I understand what you're saying, that the shortest call axe is reading the highest SWR because of the shorter length, less of a loss. So, and therefore, I can use any coax and just stick with it and balance out my antenna. You know, pick the right capacitor for what I need. I think what you're saying is, well, you gave your reasons why I'm reading different SWRs per coax length, and that's understandable. So, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'll just pick one coax and, pick a capacitor for my own antenna.
Yeah, tell me how much disparity was there in the apparent SWR. In other words, you've got a fixed capacitor, you're not changing the capacitor, and you just changed three different cable lengths. What was the highest and the lowest VISWAR you saw with nothing but a change of cable length? Back to you, Gary.
Okay, good question. I started out with the 109-inch mobile coax, which was the RG58U, and that started out with about 2.5 to 1, using a 15 puff capacitor. Then I went to a 20 puff capacitor. The match came down to about 2 to 1, using the same coax. And then I went to an 18 puff capacitor using the same coax, and the SWR dropped even a little bit more. But in answer to your question, when I first started out using, let's see here, 10, wait a minute, 15, 20, okay, if I remember correctly, I started out with 109-inch, 2.5 to 1 with the 109-inch, then I went over to the base coax, which is the RG213U. It dropped down to about, I think it was 1.9 to 1. And then using the base coax was 32? I think the base coax was 32.5 feet long, and that's what gave me the 1.9. Then I went to the 16.5? 32, yeah. 60.5 foot RG58U, and that was even a little bit lower, and understandably so.
Okay, those first two coaxes and that relatively small change from 2 1/2 down to 1.9 and the longer length of higher quality coax, a little bit more insertion loss, that all hangs together. What you saw as different visuals, once you recognize that the length of the cable gives you insertion loss lowers the apparent visual, I think that's all explained. Right now, from what you're telling me, there is a small amount of evidence that your standing wave ratio meter may have reasonable directivity. By the way, what is the brand name on your standing wave ratio meter, Gary? Go ahead.
The first one was MFJ, the second one is Diamond.
And when you compare Diamond to MFJ, do you get relatively consistent readings between the two? In other words, if one reads 2.15 and the other reads 2.0, to me that has a degree of consistency. Not ideal, but when you're getting reasonable consistency between the two, go ahead.
Yes, I would say yes, because when I read, there's a slight difference between both meters, of course, but changing the coax length and using or reading both meters, then yes, they're consistent, if not linear, if that's the right word for that. If one reads higher, then the other one will read higher too. And if one reads lower, the other one does read a little lower too.
Okay. Inconsistency to me would be 2-1 on one meter and 4-1 on the other. That's inconsistency. But one reading 2.15 and the other reading 2.00, that's close enough. That's all you can really use a visual meter for. You were playing here with about four variables at once. Number one, your buddies for years have been giving you misinformation about standing wave ratio, what it is, and the magic length of cable, whether it be resonant or non-resonant, in order to make a reading. That's one piece of information. Number two, your meter has maybe less than ideal, but maybe good enough directivity. Number three, the length of cable with that non-ideal directivity, I'm making a little bit of disturbance in the reading because of the phase angle, what gets reflected through a different length of cable. And four, your cables have different insertion losses because of their length and type. So, and five, you were playing with capacitor values, looking for the ideal visual. You were playing with a whole lot of variables at once. By way of this conversation tonight, hopefully you've got a little more understanding. The number of variables is now considerably lower. The science you're seeking is a little bit more understandable. And I think you're going to get there. And it sounds to me like you're well on the mend for that particular antenna, and where other people have discovered that particular capacitor being a troublesome thing for that particular antenna, and maybe it's a mechanical failure as well as a electronic failure, sounds to me like you're well on your way to getting that antenna back in full operation. Let us know how it finally turns out. And by the way, when you adjust a capacitor on a multi-element antenna for the best visual, there may be more than one capacitor that will give you the best visual, and depending on how many wavelengths long the antenna is, there could be a difference in the pattern that you get out of it, the elevation pattern. So I probably shouldn't be telling you this because I'm going to be worrying you, but if you happen to have the wrong capacitor, you may have a pattern that has a peak in the elevation pattern above or below the horizon. Just know that that's a possibility. And if there's a way that you can find somebody else with that exact same antenna that by one way or another is willing to tell you what size capacitor that is, that would be kind of handy. I'd like to believe if you go back to the manufacturer, he would tell you the size of that capacitor. And if you go on to the right website, there must be a group of guys out there somewhere who have run into a similar problem and they know how many picofarads that capacitor is. It'd be nice to know what was the original. Back to you, Gary, for any other comments. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yes, well, that's going to be a little bit rough because it's possible that when they made these... The schematic that he's... My intent, I have 7 capacitors there soldered to different loading coil in series parallel. The first one was 1 puff, the second one was 1.5 puff, the third one, I don't know, it exploded. The fourth one and the fifth one were both 16 puff. The sixth and the seventh were both 30 puff. Now, when he sends me the schematic, the first one was 1 puff, okay, that's where we're going. The second one was 3 puff. The third one on the schematic was 13 puff. The fourth and the fifth one were both 16 again, that's okay. But the sixth and the seventh one were 27 puff. So, talking to my friend who had the same exact problem and the same exact capacitor that exploded, he had different values yet. So I'm not going to mess with any of the capacitors. They might be handpicked. They even had spacing in millimeters for each coil. Each coil had to be spread a certain amount of distance, and each loading coil had to be a certain distance from the previous one. Let me drop. Okay. At the same time, well, all right, that's one thing. That's one thing there. The reason, getting back to 20 minutes ago, the reason why I used the formula for Q sections for a non-resonant length coax is because I did put up stack 5 vertically for 10 meters, and on top of that I put up stack 5 for 2 meters. And I set them both 10 meters and 2 meters antennas, a half wavelength apart from each other. And that's why I figured I have to use this formula, 2950 times 0.66 divided by frequency is going to be for my first Q section. And that's what I did for co-phasing my beams for 10 meters, and I did the same thing again for 2 meters. I figured, well, that kind of sparked me on this thing about why I'm going to have to do the same thing to make a non-resonant length. But, no, I appreciate your info. You opened up my eyes a little bit, and it sounds like all this coax stuff would be, you can probably see what you're talking about on a network analyzer, something I just don't have in my back pocket, because that would have came in really handy when I was doing my formulas for co-phasing the antennas, and I just had to measure them physically as most accurately as I can for that.
Hey, you were on the right track, Gary, when you stack a pair of antennas. Let's assume you're using either a T-connector to divide the power, if you're a poor man's power divider, or a real power divider. You do want exactly the same length of cable from the common point to the two antennas that you're stacking, so that the signal radiated from the two antennas comes out co-phase, in phase with each other, when it comes to the signal being sent out to the horizon. So cable lengths are critical when you're stacking antennas in the vicinity of your phasing harness, as it's called, the power divider cable assembly. And by the way, there again is a bunch of old wise tales about each cable should be the same length, yes, but now people think that there's a magic length that each one of those cables should be. In many cases, that is not, in most cases, that is not true. Just as long as they're equal from the point of commonality, the power divider. So you do want the two antennas to be in phase with each other. And you got to be careful with that one. You'll be amazed how many times a guy will mount a pair of horizontally polarized Yagis, one above the other. He's got a power divider between the two on the mast. One cable out of the power divider goes up to the upper antenna. One cable out of the power divider goes down to the lower antenna. Both of those cables are the same length. Everything looks hunky-dory. Then, because he just loves supersymmetry, he's got the bottom antenna right side up and the upper antenna upside down so that the connectors come out as close to each other into those cables, into the power divider. He completely forgets about the fact that when he takes the upper antenna and mounts it upside down, as far as where the connector comes out of the horizontal polarized Yagi is concerned, it's mechanically convenient, but by flipping that antenna, he has taken the signal coming out of the antenna and changed it 180 degrees in phase. He's made the antenna upside down with the same feed point. Now the signals coming out of the two antennas are out of phase. He's got a beautiful null on the horizon. He's got a beautiful peak 30 degrees above the horizon and a peak 30 degrees below the horizon. He stacked a pair of antennas. He expected the signal to get 3 dB louder, and it got 15 dB weaker. And he's saying, what the hell's going on here? So he'd be amazed how many people have fallen into that trap. So, now, he could get around that problem if he just loved the supersymmetry by making one of those cables a half wavelength longer electronically, including the velocity factor. But it takes a little bit of smarts in that area. Lots of guys have fallen into that trap. So, good luck with this project. You kept saying that that he mailed you a schematic. I guess it's your buddy who has a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm guessing it's your buddy who has a similar antenna who made a schematic for you. Either that or maybe you got it from Comet themselves. It'd be nice if Comet would tell you. If you called them up, I'd love to know whether they could mail you a schematic or tell you the value of that capacitor in that location. If you went directly to Comet, what do you think they would give you? And I'd love to know. They're probably not an American company. Back to you, Gary. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Well, no, okay, first of all, when I was stacking my beams, no, I didn't fall into that trap. I knew about that one already. No, I did mine just right. The only thing I did not do is face them far enough. My forward was just about, maybe 3 dB over my backward, in the back. So I didn't space them enough far apart. No, the Comet did send me a PDF. It was a schematic in Japanese of that antenna. And the only thing I can read on it was the spacing of the coils. Each coil was a certain spacing in millimeters apart from each other, and the capacitor values. And the capacitor value that he had on the schematic was 13 puffs. But I figured I cannot trust that because the values of the other capacitors were different from mine, or some of them were. And then a friend of mine who had the same antenna and had the same capacitor explode, he had yet still a different set of values. So he had to play with his as well as I did.
Okay, when your values were different than their values, were they different a lot or a little? I mean, if one of their capacitors was 5.6 and yours is 6.2, that to me is the same ballpark. Were they in the same ballpark or were they radically different? Back to you, Gary.
No, not radically different, no. No, Comet, the schematic that Comet sent me was, well, let's see, two of them were exactly the same. The last two were only three puff away. Let's see, the third one exploded, and on the schematic they're claiming it was 13 puff. The first capacitor is one puff. That's okay. That's the same as mine. But his schematic on for the second capacitor was three puff, and mine was 1.5. So no, they're very close, very close. Sorry. Nothing was radically different, but being that I didn't have a 13 puff capacitor, all I had was a 15, a 20, and an 18, and a 10. Yes, I know I can series or parallel whatever I, to make the capacitor values for that. That means I have to go search in my puff box again. Puff the magic dragon, right? It's also a thing of what can I physically fit in there, because it's a tight fit. That's probably why they use those small brown disc capacitors, because the whole thing has got to slide into that fiberglass barrel again, and I put the set screw in. So that's when I decided, well, you know what? Not only do I have to figure this out on my own, but it's going to be a very nice experiment and a learning curve and a good experiment for me to learn about this. So, yeah, it is.
Okay, and now that we know that theirs was 13 and you're in that ballpark, stop worrying about what I was talking about, and that is the elevation beam being tilted in the wrong direction. And also, I think it's a 2-meter version that you're, the 2-meter response is what I believe you're tuning up at this time, which is the one that's not going to be anywhere near as sensitive as the 440. So don't worry about that one. There's also the possibility that not only are they hand-picked, but there's probably an American version of the antenna, a European version, and a Japanese version. The United States, the 2-meter band goes from 144 to 148, where our FM band is 146 to 148. In Europe, I think the 2-meter band FM portion goes 144 to 146, and I'm not quite sure where it is in Japan. So that could account for some of the difference in capacitor, European, Japanese, or American version, as to where the FM portion of the band is located. You're in the right ballpark. You're on the right road for recovery. I think this should work out like a charm. Good luck with those experiments. Come back and let us know how it works out. And an exciting story you got there. And it sounds to me like you're going to bring that antenna back to life. Restored to life, as they used to say in the Tale of Two Cities. A GT-15 is going to be coming back on the air and filling up the ether with RF energy. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. I'm going to pass it over for anyone to complain about that if I've forgotten somebody. And then Mel, it's probably time you dig into your mailbag before it gets too late, and you don't want to get those guys angry at us. K2KEY to take it with a little bit of foot dragging. K2LIW in the tech net.
K2KEY, you with a comment?
Oh, yeah, you did have a set of questions, too. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, actually, this wasn't really for a set of questions, but just to add a little bit to what you were saying about, you know, measuring the antennas and everything. I know it sounds like most of the experiments you were taking were with F51 meters, which definitely, you know, works, and it's a little bit more painstaking. But one of the things I know, because I love working on antennas whenever I can get a chance, and using one of those MFJ antenna analyzers or some of the other manufacturers' antenna analyzers, I happen to like the MFJ. I purchased it. It was cheap enough where, you know, looking at an antenna, and you can really sweep through the band and see, like you're saying, a lot of times the capacitor differences could just be a point in the band where it's a little optimized for one end to the other, where, you know, when you're just looking at one frequency of the transceiver in the F51 meter, it's a little bit hard to get the whole big picture of what's really happening with the antenna. I don't know, maybe we've got some more thoughts about it.
Yeah, this is the best of all worlds.
It
would be nice to have a real RX meter and its various versions of that, homebrew and commercially made, or a network analyzer is the best of all worlds, where you can independently look at it on a Smith chart or independently measure the resistive component and the reactive component. That's the complete story, the whole magilla. Just using a scalar, you know what a vector voltmeter is, a scalar network analyzer is one which just tells you reflection coefficient magnitude. There are scalar network analyzers. And a bird watt meter is one of the versions where you just measure forward power or reverse power. And that is enough information to do a good tuning job. The extra information about what is the resistive component, what is the reactive component, gives you a little bit more steering, so to speak, to know if you're high or low of resonance and what's happening. Is the reactive component moving faster as it usually does? Although some antenna designs, as you sweep in frequency, there's a slim possibility the resistance component could be moving. Most antennas, the reactive component moves most rapidly as you change frequency. The resistance component usually moves very slowly. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. Almost all the antennas we use are standing wave structures where within the antenna itself, they typically have a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. Your beautiful 80-meter dipole, 131 feet long, within the wire of the dipole itself is something like a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. That signal that you apply to that antenna, you think it's a beautiful 72 ohm resistor with the twin lead you might be feeding it with. Let me drop. And that signal doesn't get immediately radiated. We all would like to believe the signal crawls down that wire and jumps into space. Nothing could be further from the truth. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 20 times in a row before the energy of that signal finally goes out into space. So the signal bounces back and forth on that wire, usually more than 20 times. What you and I call resonance is making sure that all of those bounces stay in step. That's why we're electronically making the antenna the right length, so that after all those 20 bounces, the signal is still in phase with the signal coming out of the transmitter at this time. That's what you and I call resonance. And if you make the antenna a little bit too short, the bounces start leaving in phase, and we call that capacitor reactance. One and the same. There's two different sets of words. So resonance, the bottom line of all this is that any reasonable antenna that you can lay your hands on, with only two exceptions, you resonate first, then you radiate. Yes, you can make a leaky 50 ohm resistor and it radiates, but it radiates 25 dB down from a good dipole. That's not really radiation. That's leakage. Electromagnetic interference leakage. But real antennas resonate first, then you radiate. I haven't seen those words in any respected antenna book. And yet, it conveys the concept of what's going on. Real radiation is not the electrons you pumped into the antenna jumping into space. Not one single electron per se leaves that antenna. The current flow of those electrons your transmitter is pumping into that antenna, which bounce back and forth 20 times before their energy is primarily dissipated. The current that you're pumping creates a magnetic field. It's the magnetic field that creates the electromagnetic wave, the TEM wave, that gets radiated into space. And you want the current to be the highest to make the strongest magnetic field. The current is the highest when all of those 20 bounces are in step with each other. That's why you get the greatest resonance, you get the greatest radiation at resonance. There is no book I know of that explains it that way. That leads me to believe the people who wrote the book went by the tradition of the physics department that taught them antenna theory, starting off with Maxwell's equations, which are good, good, basic, concrete, what's the word I'm looking for? Base of the building, so to speak, foundation is the word I'm looking for. Good basic foundation. But it's too many steps from what really happens, the bottom line that creates the signal that we care about. And so a person who has a little more understanding of what an antenna does knows that it's a standing wave structure. The only antennas that are not standing wave structures, where the signal goes down once, is called rhombic or beverage. That's the only ones I know of.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I know I'm off on my usual hobby horse, but I think it's a truth that bears repeating, and I only repeat this as a little tirade once every three or four tech minutes, but eventually somebody is going to say, yeah, that gives me a little more feeling for what's happening. At times, somebody put it in the book so that a respected textbook on the subject of antennas, so that a few more people can grasp the basic action of what's going on with an antenna, so they know a little bit more about how to tune them, how to understand them, how to design better ones, and so on. I mean, there are 5,000 kinds of antennas in existence right now. You open up the Antenna Engineering Handbook by either Melanus or Modern Antenna Handbook by, that's Melanus, or Skolnick, Skolnick is the radar handbook, sorry about that, Jacek, or Volakis. The fourth edition of Antenna Engineering Handbook is by Volakis. And Melanus has just come out with a brand new book, which is also very good. A little on the pricey side, it's around $150. But each of those will show you 5,000 kinds of antennas. You can easily fall into the trap of one of the presidents back in 1910 who said, gee, we've done everything we can with the patent office, it's time we close it down. We've invented everything. And the modern automobile in 1910 is so good, we don't have to build any more of this. We'll just keep building this one from now on. both of those guys are very naive. So even though there were 5,000 antennas, you could think that all the antennas have been invented. Well, I've been involved in 17 patents on antennas in the last 4 years. And so the people I work with think they're coming up with brand new antennas. They good reason to believe so, because a number of those patents are being granted. Once you have an understanding of antennas, you can make modifications of them. They usually are not expensive in the materials. We've got enough room in our backyard to do a lot of experimenting. We've got this beautiful ham radio license, which gives us 25 different ham bands or more to experiment in. And it is a beautiful license for a guy who wants to tinker. Let me drop. Yeah, the FCC has given us this beautiful license where we're allowed to tinker. We've got a tremendous amount of spectrum, every octave of the band, where if you want to build an antenna on 160, 80, 40, 15, 20, 10, 17, 6 meters, 2 meters, 1 and a quarter meters, it just goes on and on and on. You've got a whole lot of percentage of bandwidth in every one of those bands. Every piece of electronics you create with your own hand is automatically type accepted by the FCC. You don't have to go through a great big approval process to build that piece of electronics and put it on the air and start transmitting. As long as you don't exceed the power output or the frequency ranges where you're supposed to be, so you get an official observer report after doing that, as long as you stay within your own backyard as far as the frequencies are concerned that we've been allocated, we can experiment with any one of those bands with zillions of kinds of antennas. And as I said before, the materials usually are not expensive. The performance improvement you can make is significant. None of us are going to build an 80 to 10 meter transceiver these days. There's a darn many integrated circuits. They're so complicated. You lay down 1 or 2 weeks' salary and you buy the darn thing. You don't spend a year of your life building one of those. If you spend a few hours of your life building an antenna, you're going to have a lot of fun, make a lot of breakthroughs. There's a lot more to be done. And with the proper understanding, more of us could be doing it. It isn't rocket science. Once you learn a few basics, the real people doing antenna design, day to day, if you knew the very small number of rules of thumb that they operate with, they spend an awful lot of their time making sure the standing wave ratio, as they call it, which is really reflection coefficient, S11, as an S parameter, reflection coefficient, keep that number below some number to keep the customer happy, and that's where an awful lot of their work really is, matching the reflection coefficient across the particular frequency band. Occasionally they're tuning for a maximum gain or a certain beam width or a certain polarization characteristic or circular polarization with a certain axial ratio. But the real antenna designers are using a series of rules of thumb that you can easily write them down on one sheet of paper. And once you understand those rules of thumb on that one sheet of paper, really understand them, you could be in the antenna design business. In my opinion, a beautiful business to be in, because the schools do not teach the subject. You'll be treated with a tremendous amount of respect if you have that skill. People will beat a path to your door. They will hand you a whole lot of money. They will hand you a whole lot of work. It's a beautiful relationship. I've been doing it as a consultant for the last 7 years, and it's one of the most fun times I've ever had. I don't have to be alone doing that. Enough of you guys listening to me could learn what I'm doing. It ain't that complicated in some respects. Take some experience. But if you really want an antenna engineer,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you really want an antenna engineer, 90% of the time you will hire a real ham radio operator. That's where the skill and the experience and the tinkering capability is coming from. The hands-on experience. That's where it's coming from. The schools do not teach it. Very few companies are smart enough to set up an apprenticeship program. So by way of that technique, a small number of skilled antenna engineers they've got, which have got white hair and they're retiring, and they could be passing on that knowledge with an apprenticeship program so that there's more antenna engineers within the company. A very valuable resource. I'd like to believe that a smart company would realize that the white hair guys are leaving and retiring, and they're taking away their notebook and their knowledge, and it could be passed on, and almost none of the companies I've ever heard of on the East Coast, and maybe it's just as bad on the West Coast, are smart enough to pass on that knowledge to set up an apprenticeship program. It doesn't even have to be a formal apprenticeship program. 1 or 2 hours a week you take your new graduate engineers and you let them sit side by side with the guy who's doing the real antenna work, who's about to retire. Just let him look over the shoulder and ask questions. That's all it would take to pass on a tremendous amount of knowledge. You say those words to a department manager or a section head within a company, and he thinks you're crazy. We've never done it that way. Why should we do it that way now? To which my answer would be, if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you always got. And you'll always be shy on antenna engineers. You'll never have enough of them. If you're in the RF business, your RF equipment is not going to work unless you connect it to an antenna. And if you keep setting up your business in such a way that you're dependent on outsourcing of the antenna, which means you're letting some other company, you're letting some other company do the research and development for you, charge you a whole lot of money, and then charge you royalty for everything that you ship, and you don't really have control of it, and you're building somebody else's mediocre design as opposed to your much better design by your guys that have got the passion for that particular project. Picture a guy who is developing a handheld project that's got radio requirement inside. He's got the passion for that project. He's lived with it for the last 6 months. It's his baby. He wants it to live well and proper. He wants it to work well. He wants it to be successful. And it's not going to be successful if it doesn't have a good antenna. And if his department, if his company doesn't have a good antenna design department in it, then he's going to most likely get a mediocre antenna design. I think you see where I'm going here. Yeah, I know, I'm way off on one side. Hey, Glenn, look what you caused. Sorry about that. K2QIQ, K2, here we go. KD2QIQ, K2RIW in the segment.
Questions?
He's like, I got to be careful about what I ask you. But, yeah, just looking up the MFC analyzer. But I, the only reason I brought that up is because the analyzer is just a heck of a nice thing. This weekend, you know, I was putting up my VHF tower, and every antenna that I put up, I, you know, had a nice, you know, 25-foot piece of coax, checked each antenna from ground level and each level of, you know, of installation, putting it up, and what a pleasure, because this way I knew before I connected up the coax to the radio, the whole antenna system was flying. And, for such a small little piece of equipment, you know, what a big job it does. And, you know, that's about all I was going to say. K2RIWKB2QIQ. I think there was somebody else right behind me.
Yeah, sorry, I get off the door. My favorite tirade, I think I do this once every 3 or 4 tech minutes. The person with a question, go right ahead. Start off with your name, your call letters. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick, no, it's just Gary once more. I just want to pack it in for tonight, but I just wanted to ask you one more thing, because there's something you said before that was an old wives' tale in stacking beams. Now, was that on the aspect of odd multiples? You do not have to go in odd multiples. And yes, I was using a T connector.
In most cases, a T connector is a darn good poor man's power divider. It only gives you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio if you didn't do something to correct it. And if the antenna was a 50 ohm antenna, and if the feed lines that you used between the T-connector and the antenna were odd numbers of quarter wavelength of, let me think about this, 70 ohm cable. An odd number of quarter wavelength of 70 ohm cable connected to a 50 ohm antenna will make the input impedance to that cable 100 ohms. And you're bringing together at the T-connector now a pair of 100 ohm cables, so to speak, and that in parallel makes 50. So, with an odd number of quarter wavelengths of the cable from the T connector, odd number of quarter wavelengths of 70 ohm cable to the 50 ohm antennas, you get a beautiful impedance match. And you don't have to use a real power divider. A T connector is perfect. If you didn't do it that way, if you used any old length of cable that's 50 ohms, just make sure that both of them are equal in length, and bring them together, a pair of 50 ohms in parallel is 25. 25 ohms on that T connector is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. That ain't bad. That's a half dB of potential loss. You're on the air, you've got, of the 3 dB of potential gain, you've got 2.5 dB of it if you didn't correct it back at the transmitter, the 2-to-1 VISWA, so to speak. When you correct the VISWA back at the transmitter, as long as your feed line is low enough in loss, your transmission line, what you're really doing when you're readjusting the transmitter to tolerate the 2-to-1, if you've got an antenna tuner, is you're re-reflecting that that reflected power at the transmitter, re-reflecting it forward in phase with the power the transmitter is now generating. And the antenna gets another chance to radiate it. So even the half dB of loss may not be there if your feed line is low enough and long. When you adjust your antenna tuner, you think you're adjusting impedance. And you think the antenna is taking that reflected power and absorbing it. It's got no dissipative capability. It can't absorb reflected power. It re-reflects it forward in phase. That's what you're doing when you adjust your antenna tuner. Again, no good textbook I know of says those words. You say those words on the 20-meter band on a Saturday afternoon, and a hell of a lot of people will say you're crazy. They don't believe it because they've heard another story so often that the other story has become the quote truth unquote, and it's a phony truth. A good antenna tuner, properly made, runs ice cold. You're putting 100 watts through it. You think 50 watts is being reflected from the antenna. You think it's absorbing 50 watts. It'd be getting hot as all hell and glowing if it did.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The transmitter is not dissipating the reflected power once it sees a 2-to-1 disrupt. It thinks it sees a 50 ohm load. The antenna tuner takes the 50 watts of reflected power on the 100 watts going forward of my example and re-reflects it forward. Yeah, the bird watt meter will show some ridiculous amount of power going forward. By the way, it's not 150. Power doesn't add, voltage adds. But we won't go there right now. You'll see more than the right amount of power going forward on a good, well-calibrated bird watt meter. You'll wonder what's going on. You'll see 50 watts going forward, coming back, and maybe you're going to see 170 going forward, even though the transmitter is only generating 100. This power bouncing back and forth in the feed line before it finally gets radiated. But still, with a good antenna tuner on a high vis wire antenna with a low enough loss feed line, you can still have 98% radiation efficiency. So, is vis wire always bad? Not necessarily. Particularly when you view the fact that within the antenna itself, the vis wire is almost always 20-to-1 and higher. That's how the antenna radiates. Is vis wire bad? I'd say no. As long as you have control of it, VisWire is the method by which you radiate. No book says that. Another way of looking at all this jazz. Oh, with you, Gary, you probably got some more questions on all this. KB2JXM, K2RIW.
Very interesting. Very interesting. It sounds logical, too. No, the only thing I was questioning is I thought you said that odd multiples was a wives' tale. I wasn't sure. You did say that make sure both lengths were, you know, exactly the same. You want both of them in phase at the same phase angle. But I thought you said the odd multiples was a wives' tale. So I'm thinking, oh, okay. I guess I can get away with even multiples as long as they're both the same length, but you're saying odd multiples now, so I guess we're sticking with odd multiples.
Oh. Odd multiples only if you're using it as an impedance matching device on a T connector. To get a perfect impedance match, the T connector should not be looking into 50 ohms, but looking into a pair of 100s. There, using a quarter wavelength of cable as an impedance inverter. 50 ohms going into a quarter wave of 70 ohm cable, it's called a quarter wave matching transformer, gives you 100 ohms at the input of that particular cable. I wonder if that makes some sense, Gary, go ahead.
Oh, exactly, yeah, because impedance reflects itself every half lambda. So that's why I had to do 2950 times my coax dielectric constant divided by frequency. And yes, I did use a T-connector. Yes, I did use RG11, which is 75 ohm coax. That was the closest thing to 70.7. And the square root of 5,000, yes, you're correct, comes to 70.7 ohms. And that's what I had to use, and I did use my third multiple. I didn't want to go past that because of the loss in the coax. But physically, where my antennas are mounted distance-wise apart from each other, I was able to use the third multiple.
Understand. So, if you weren't doing simultaneous impedance matching, if you were using a real power divider, you could have used 50 ohm cables to each of the two antennas, equal in length, and the exact length wouldn't matter as long as they're equal. You were doing two things at once, power dividing and impedance matching with a T connector instead of a power divider. And if you really wanted to be a purist, it'd be nice to have a real power divider that has a built-in termination so that the unbalanced power gets absorbed and you get isolation between the two antennas. With antennas, you don't need it. But when you're combining the power from two amplifiers, you really shouldn't use a T-connector. I mean, if I had a pair of Mirage amplifiers, let's say, for instance, I'm using Mirage Baker 1016. Each one's good for 160 watts, but I want 320 watts. And I want to put a pair of those into a transmitter setup. Logically, you would think I'd take a T-connector, a quarter wavelength of a 70-ohm cable to each amplifier on the input, do the same thing on the output, and you would think you're combining the power. You do that with Mirage amplifiers, and you're going to build not a 320-watt transmitter, you're going to build a 320-watt oscillator, and I'm not kidding. 90% of the time, it'll break into oscillation, because that T-connector arrangement, although on paper it gives you a good impedance match, it has no isolation between those transmitters. Any power coming out of transmitter number one can get into transmitter number two, both on the input connector and the output connector, and those amplifiers are basically conditionally stable. They just love to oscillate if they don't see 50 ohms DC to light on each input connector and output connector. Whereas if you use a real quadrature hybrid power divider, or a Wilkinson hybrid power divider, something that's got a built-in termination which creates isolation so that none of the signal from the first amplifier is capable of getting into the second amplifier. You combine the power in that manner. Now you've got a stable network for 320 watts of output. You'd be amazed how many guys have tried to do it with T-connectors and they ended up with smoke and flames. Because those amplifiers, even going into a good antenna, might break into oscillation. You know, you unkey the transmitter and you're still on the air. You've heard of stories like that. And you have to change the length of cable to the antenna or between the exciter and the amplifier in order to make the system stable. You get that combination where the amplifier itself, with its conditional stability, doesn't like the fact that the antenna is a perfect 50 ohm load at 146 megacycles, but on the second harmonic it's a shorter and open circuit. Shorter
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Almost every antenna you and I have ever used, with rare exception, has a beautiful impedance match at the design frequency. Yet on all other frequencies, it's some really yucky impedance. And a transistorized amplifier with a D-swing on its collector junction and on its emitter base junction, it's just built for parametric oscillation. It looks for any other resonance in the system, and it would just love to take off and oscillate on that resonance. And an antenna connected to one of those amplifiers fits that bill beautifully, because the antenna is only a good impedance match at the design frequency. Therefore, your length of cable becomes a cavity resonator between that antenna and that amplifier, and it'll take off and oscillate. Match a pair of those amplifiers with good quadrature hybrids, and even though you're combining amplifiers and you think it's going to be less stable because of the isolation you get from those hybrids, the chances are very good that you'll have a much more stable system when combining a pair of them correctly as opposed to using one of them directly to the antenna. Opposite of common sense. Okay, you guys have had enough of this jazz. I keep going off on opposite tangents here. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this before we go back to Mel and finally let him go to his mailbag? Give me a call at us right now, H-U-R-I-W in the TechNet. Okay, we finally quieted him down, Mel. K2KEY, you got the floor, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, fine business there. All right, well, like I say, I always pick out some interesting ones here and try to filter the, in a way, basically a high-Q filter emailer here to try to pick out what is most interesting and basic amateur radio situation. So I'm just reading over here. Okay. Here's one that I've gotten quite a number. Questions on this. What exactly is all this business about K and the A index? And what does it all mean? So, would you like to make a comment first before I go ahead with this stick over?
I'm going to pass that one back to you. I'm so light on HF theory because I'm a VHF, UHF, SHF person. When it comes to the ionosphere and what the National Bureau of Standards will tell you about it with the A and the K index and so on, I'm pretty light on that one. So tell me anything. You'll be telling me something I don't know, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay. WWV. Transmits every 18 minutes after the hour the daily K indices. Now, this actually is they actually transmit both the K and the A. The K indices is an up-to-date reading that is supplied by the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, known as NOAA. They supply 8 measurements a day, and the current measurement every 3 hours, taking 3 hours, eight a day, 3 hours apart, and WWV every 18 minutes after the hour will give you the updated K index that they just received from NOAA. However, the A index is the averaging of the entire measurement. In other words, they take the 8 measurements a day and they multiply them together, and that gives you the A index. Maybe that's a little complicated. I don't know. Maybe I didn't explain it right. So in other words, if you took 8 times a day and each reading of the A, the K index was, say, 3. Let's say, and it was done 8 times a day. So it would be 8 times 3 would be, in other words, the A index then would be 24. 8 times 3 is 24. Now, what does this all mean? Let me really drop. Okay. Now, what does it mean? The K index goes from 0 to 9. Now, 0 being basically what we call the minimum reading, which means little or no disturbance. And then we have the 9, which means that it's a maximum of disturbance. So when working with, HF especially, you know that if you have a low reading, so-called the index of 0 or close to it, that there's good conditions, that the conditions will be, you know, somewhat good, and, things like noise levels and all that will be, fairly quiet and all. In fact, I'll say one more about this. If the reading is high, and let's say the K index goes as high as, say, 9, that means extreme storm conditions on the sun, and HF propagation may be impossible. However, VHF aurora propagation is usually then comes into play. So when you say you have some openings on 2 meters, there's a good chance that we have a somewhat higher K index take over.
Okay, now let me play back what I think I've heard and correct me on this one. I think K is the state of solar flux or solar activity, which is, so to speak, live. I'm going to guess that the A is the integration of the last eight readings, the smooth number. Is the A the smooth number and the K the raw?